Welcome back to Coach Enya Below the Bar podcast. Now, today I have a special guest on, Brian O'Hina. So I think I'm pronouncing his surname correctly. It's in Asquelga. Brian is a nutrition coach since 2017. He is a psychotherapist and he helps so many people with disordered eating patterns and helps them come out the other side, have a better relationship with food and exercise. And it's something that I might not be fully educated on myself. It's not my area of expertise. I've often had clients in the past that have actually referred to Brian who I suppose aren't just ready to go into a calorie deficit. They need to fix underlying issues before they can succeed with a calorie deficit. And that could be something like emotional eating, disordered eating, self-sabotage, binge eating, etc. And when you get to the root cause of that, you can finally come out the other side and conquer a calorie deficit. Sometimes people think a calorie deficit is the solution, when in fact you have to deal with the underlying issues first before you can conquer something like that. And that's where someone like Brian comes in, and today I'm going to pick his brains. But look, sit back, enjoy, and I hope that you take away something from this podcast, because I definitely did. Brian, you're very welcome to the podcast. So I know I just gave you a brief intro, but for anyone who hasn't heard of you or is aware of what you do, can you just give us a bit of background on how you help people, the purpose of your page on social media, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely, Enya. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to have this chat. So my background is initially I did a degree in nutrition like over 10 years ago now. I qualified from that. And then I started working with people online in a one-to-one nutrition and lifestyle coaching capacity. So I've been doing that for quite a while now. And I worked with all types of goals and all sorts of people, you know, throughout that time. And one that I came across, you know, quite regularly and a type of issue that I sort of enjoyed helping people with was disordered eating and people having sort of significant challenges with their relationship with food and maybe their relationship with their bodies and their body image. So I was sort of applying kind of cognitive behavior techniques to coaching people in that context, maybe whether I knew it at the time or not. But I enjoyed that and found it very rewarding to help people get that kind of freedom when it comes to, you know, the relation with food and the kind of self-criticism that they're experiencing and the rigidity around that and all that disordered eating. And then I decided a few years ago to go and get a master's in psychotherapy and counseling so I could help people with actual eating disorders as well, with the same sorts of issues. So and we did a master's in cognitive behavior therapy, which is the best treatment for eating disorders in adults overall. And so now that's what I've been doing for the last few years, as well as the nutrition coaching. So I see some clients who are just doing nutrition coaching. I see some clients who are just doing therapy. And then I see some clients that are doing both, all in the one, depending on what it is they need help with and what their goals are. So that's where I'm at now.
What are some of the most common issues your clients come to you with? Like, I know disordered eating would be one of them, but I suppose what would you be most known for? Like, is it just disordered eating? Is it anything else? Would it say body image, self-sabotage? If you just want to kind of delve into that a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, so all these things are kind of connected, I suppose, is one thing to consider, that sort of poor body image is a main driver of disordered eating, because, you know, what pushes people into disordered behaviors in relation to maybe food or exercise? Well, it's maybe low sense of self-worth or putting too much of their eggs in the basket of what my body looks like, for where their sense of self-worth is. Or, you know, for a lot of people with eating disorders, you know, the way that manifests is based on them trying to cope with something in their lives. So the food is kind of the solution, or the lack of food is the solution, so to speak, and not necessarily the problem. So like eating disorders are said to have sort of common risk factors and common characteristics for people who have them. So there's things like perfectionism, there's things like low sense of self-worth, challenges with like emotions and like how strong emotions are and how do they relate to them. And then, kind of life stress and relationship stresses. And then some of the main sort of risk factors for any sort of disordered eating are going to be sort of this high, what's called like high appearance investment. Like, so that again, put a lot of my eggs in that basket of my sense of self, my identity is tied in to what I look like and my physical appearance, as opposed to it being like that's part of it. But then, I also think of how I am as a person and relationships that I have and my career and things that I'm studying and hobbies and stuff like that. So that's quite diverse in terms of where someone has their identity. But yeah, I would work with a lot of people with, say, emotional eating issues, binge eating issues. But I have clients with all types of eating disorders, really. And then that kind of preoccupation and rigidity when it comes to food and just like feeling stuck with like just not really sure how they can manage eating normally, and sort of food being on their mind, and the concerns about the relationship with food being on their mind, too much basically. That's what we want to address.
Do you think it's a learned behavior, like from, the environment that they grew up in, or do you think it's like societal pressures from, like, I suppose, being exposed to so much online, like their algorithm, people, I suppose fitness influencers as well, who would be quite extreme with their diets also. And I suppose just the normal Joe soap, assuming that that's the type of lifestyle they have to live to maintain or to look like that,
It's going to be a bit of both, like, to be honest. Early experiences are very influential on how someone relates to these things. So I often talk to clients about like they'll pick up baggage, throughout their lives, and that's just based on their experiences, so you could have somebody who was bullied for their weight when they were younger. And that drove them towards, okay, well, I don't feel safe when I'm in a bigger body. And there's been that kind of hostility towards me. So if I'm smaller, then I'll be safer and more accepted by the group. Because a lot of this stuff kind of stems from our very primal biological aversion to rejection. So, evolutionarily, if we were quote unquote rejected from the tribe, like we're fucked, right? We're in a pretty bad way, in that case. So we're very, very sensitive as a species to rejection. So how do we avoid rejection? Well, we can conform to societal norms such as body and physique ideals, and then strive towards that, and then of course, then there's all the other kind of bits intertwined with that, that, you'll be happier and more successful, and everything will be hunky dory if you just have the body and the lifestyle. So it's very, it's the kind of media culture, and then the early life, well, not just early life experience, but just life experiences in general. And then, yeah, I would work a lot of say women who have like mothers who are talking about diets all the time and probably didn't have a good relationship with food themselves. So then they're in that environment growing up, and how people talk about weight and certain foods is really influential. And then, the mothers in that case are just subject to the same messaging and things as the kids are, right? So it's like they don't necessarily know any better. But I think in the more modern day, it's just so much more relentless, that messaging, because of things like social media. Just make it in your face constantly for as long as for as long as you're on one of those apps, it's essentially you're going to be hit with it. So yeah, there's lots of other kind of like genetics comes into it as well. You see that too. So it's like, is someone vulnerable in that sense? And then does the right environment and experience like coalesce to push them into that sort of a pattern, basically? Because you wouldn't say like, oh yeah, someone has an eating disorder because of social media. Like, it's not that. simplistic, but in the right set of circumstances for that person, yeah, it could be part of the problem, or maybe the straw that breaks the camel's back, in a sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's definitely not helping, you know. And I think a lot of I've coached a lot of people in over the years, and you know, with coaching so many people, the chances of someone popping up that isn't as straightforward to coach in terms of it's not just going to a calorie deficit, yeah, no problem, they go off and do that, and you know, they drop body fat over time, and you'll get a lot of clients like that. And then you get other clients who you start to notice a pattern that, you know, there could be a lot of self-sabotage, a lot of binge eating, etc. That pops up frequently. Now I know, like, we can all kind of overdo it if we're in a calorie deficit and we go on a night out, or you know, there's a big party coming up and we overeat. That's fine. But when it becomes a pattern, and then like the, I suppose, beating yourself up and berating yourself, and like you said, kind of tying it to your self-worth that you're a failure, etc. I think a lot of people, well, sorry, a portion of people that have come to me have put on weight due to emotional eating or binge eating or stress eating. And they think that, okay, well, I need to lose weight now because this is the consequence of that type of eating. So if I go into a calorie deficit, I'll get rid of it and then I'll feel better. But then they forget that the root of it is still there. Like, they're still going to turn to food in times of stress, even if they're in a calorie deficit. So I try to explain that we, you know, you need to fix that part first before you can have a better relationship with food. And that's where someone like yourself comes in. Would you agree to that extent, or could I be way off?
Yeah, no, I think that's bang on. Yeah, I think anyone who comes maybe to work with me, maybe they want to lose weight because of what you just said. If they've been emotionally eating or binge eating, but what I always say that like we need to address the binge eating itself first, or the emotional eating itself first, because otherwise you're just sort of paddling a canoe upstream, and it'll get very frustrating that. Because you might be fine to stick to a deficit. Like that might not be the limiting factor. The restriction, depending on how someone does it, could put them more at risk of something like binge eating for sure. But someone could be very confident or capable in, say, structuring their nutrition well and following that, but they may not have the skills to deal with the stress or the emotional side, and how do we actually manage that? And that's, I suppose, where the kind of therapeutic element comes in. That because like CBT is very sort of proactive, and like I'm for to a large extent like teaching people skills of how to relate to their thoughts and how to relate to their emotions and feelings in a more helpful way that allows them to not be thrown off by that. So I can feel anxious, or I can feel angry, or I can feel upset, and I have ways to regulate that or deal with that that don't always end up in me, eating, and then that works against maybe the other goals that I might have. So yeah, no, absolutely. So it's not something that a calorie deficit is going to solve, unfortunately.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, when it comes to that, those situations as well, like, I suppose just before I recommend someone like yourself, I think people forget that you were speaking about CBT, like cognitive behavior therapy. So I suppose it's just like that inner dialogue, and it's changing that inner dialogue. Instead of, I'm a failure, I knew I couldn't stick to this, I fail at everything, I'm not cut out for this, I'll just start again on Monday. Instead of, I suppose I used to be like that, you know, and it's, I think people forget that they have the ability to talk to themselves in a different way, and it doesn't have to be negative. But of course, that doesn't happen overnight, and that takes consistency and practice and self-awareness, and just kind of not making it out to be like black or white thinking, like, I'm a failure, I can't, you know, using those kind of like definitive statements. And it's okay, it's just one day, it's not life or death. Where I feel like some people do treat it like it's an all or nothing approach, and if you're not perfect, then you won't be able to lose weight, you know. Would you have any client success stories, or you know, even in, I suppose, recently, that you can kind of reference, like someone who came to you and how they overcame, whether it be disordered eating, emotional eating, etc.?
Yeah, geez, a lot over the years. So, I mean, I'd say like there's quite common features amongst like these clients. So, I can give you kind of a general approach of how I would try to address this. So, a lot of people have a lot of trouble with their thought patterns. And the sort of branch of CBT that I most use is called acceptance and commitment therapy. So that approach is built around something called psychological flexibility, which is defined as, can I have the internal experiences that I have, such as thoughts, such as feelings? And I'm using feelings as like a broad or a catch-all term of like cravings, impulses, emotions, sensations in the body. And then thoughts are excuses, justifications, judgments, evaluations, rationalizing, like all those are a cognitive experience. So can I have those kinds of experiences and still take action in the way that helps me move towards my goals? So a big part of it then is also goal setting and what does that actually look like, values clarification, and what does a meaningful, rich life look like to somebody. And then so to build psychological flexibility, you need to be sort of more comfortable with having your thoughts. So the approach that's used in acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT as it's known, is called cognitive diffusion. So this means to be able to essentially notice and name and neutralize the thoughts that you're having, because what we're trying to teach is that thoughts are just, and self-talk, is an example of a thought as well. And a lot of people that I work with are dealing with quite a loud and nasty inner critic, and that's like a, I often talk about like it's like a Spotify playlist, so okay, here goes the critical playlist again. How fantastic for me, this is great, this is popping up again. But that's just an example of like noticing it when it's starting to kick off. And we want to basically be able to create some space between the part of us that notices the thoughts that we're having and the thoughts themselves. So we would say that if someone is fused to their thoughts, they're getting all tangled up in them, and then they're potentially driving how they feel, it's driving how they behave. And that causes all sorts of problems for people actually acting in the way that they want, right? So, a very simple example is, I shouldn't have this food, whatever it is, right? So that can, if people start getting into kind of a back and forth with that, it can become quite taxing and distressing. But if you just notice that, oh, okay, I'm having the thought now that I shouldn't have that food. Okay, now what are my actual goals and what action would take me in that direction? So kind of treat thoughts as like being somewhat meaningless if they're not helpful. And then another sort of rule of thumb is like, if I follow the guidance of this thought, would it help me achieve the goals that I have, or have more of the life that I want to have, be more of the type of person that I want to be? So basically trying to disempower the thoughts that we have and just let them be there, as okay, the mind is going to bring thoughts to us constantly, all day, every day, about in different versions and about different things. So if we can just kind of hold space for like, okay, there it goes, I can see all the thoughts there, I can notice them, but I don't have to buy into them or get tangled up in them. So there can be a bit of work that goes into that, of course, but especially where someone is super self-critical, for example, or the thoughts are quite shaming and harsh. And ultimately that is going back to the sort of self-preservation that I alluded to earlier, that the kind of critical part. Sometimes an exercise that I'll do in session is like, let's interview the critic, right? And see, like, why are you the way that you are, and what's your intentions here with Enya, for example. And it usually comes back to like, I'm trying to drive them on so that they're protected or safe or fit in, so to avoid that rejection that I mentioned. So there can be a bit of work in like building that up as a skill, but it's basically to get thoughts to the point that are, they don't really matter unless we decide that they matter. And and a common sort of challenge with that is like, well, what if I believe the thought that I have? So beliefs are just another type of thought in this context. So again, it doesn't really matter if you believe it. Does getting hooked by that thought help you achieve the goals that you have? If it doesn't, or does it help you have more of the life that you want to have? And if it doesn't, then we try and notice and name and neutralize it. So that's a very typical starting points on the thought side. And then I can go on to the sort of feeling side if you want as well, because that'd be the other
Yeah.
kind of main thing that I would work through with people. It's usually like a bit of a coin toss of like, we start with the thought side or we start with the feeling side. But in the feeling side, it's sort of a case that when I start to notice certain sensations in my body, in order to make them go away, because I'm finding that difficult. And it can be positive, emotions as well. Like sometimes people are quite surprised at that. They're like, why would I sort of binge eat when I'm happy? But if they sort of never learned to sort of process strong emotions, or maybe it was discouraged, like maybe if you were a kid and you got excited, and then it was like quote unquote overexcited and you were told to calm down, right? Your kind of message there that like it's not okay to be, feel the full extent and express this. So it can be kind of so-called positive or negative emotions, but I do think they all just boil down to sensations in the body at the end of the day. And also I think, I think societally we're kind of there's messaging to say that like, we shouldn't have bad feelings necessarily and then try to avoid them, which is a lot of what those behaviors of like coping, disordered eating disorders are there to do, so I always talk to people about the payoffs that their so-called bad behaviors have, because they do have payoffs, there's something in it for you. And a lot of the time it's avoiding discomfort or it's feeling better or a combination, and there's a few other sort of key payoffs that are most common. But basically with that, then we're trying to help someone get more comfortable with the feeling experience, whatever it may be. So we do some exercises of sort of curiously exploring that. And there's a lot of mindfulness built into this as well. Like that's one of the key components of psychological flexibility, because that helps you observe what's going on. But we do an exercise of like, okay, where is the feeling in the body? How would you describe it? Does it have a shape? Does it have borders? Is it moving? Does it have a color? Does it have a temperature? Is it heavy? Is it light? Is it sort of going all the way through you, or is it sitting in the middle, or is it sitting kind of surface level? So all that is kind of abstract, and it's not about like, come on, Annie, what color is it? Like, tell me. It's more about your spending time with that, as opposed to like just turning away from it immediately. So in ACT, we sort of revert to this idea that we want to open up to our experiences. We want to be present. That's the mindfulness part. And then we want to do the right thing, which is take an action in the way that serves us best overall. So what I'm talking about here is a lot of the opening up part, the like opening up to the thoughts that I have, as opposed to like trying to block them out or suppress them or fight with them. Opening up to the feelings that I have in my body, instead of trying to shut them off or trying to suppress them or numb them with like substances. And then if we can do that, then we can get a bit more just comfortable with the experience of having those feelings. You don't have to like the feeling, but we try to make space for it. And there's elements of this that use the breath to kind of imagine making space for that. And that would be one of the main ways that I would sort of help people with the making space for emotions or feelings. And that can be applied to like cravings and urges and impulses and all sorts of feelings, right? It's okay. What does this actually feel like for me?
But for someone who would be listening to this podcast and is trying to decide whether do I have disordered eating patterns or am I just someone who struggles to say no to my granny when she offers me a slice of cake, or I prefer short-term gratification and just find it hard to say no to people, what would be the difference? And do you deal with both of those types, or is it mainly just towards people who rely on food, for obviously fulfilling emotional needs and lean on food in times of stress, etc. What would be the difference between people who just struggle to say no or people who genuinely just self-sabotage, binge eat, etc.? Like for someone who's listening and can't decide which camp they're in.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And yeah, I would certainly work with people in both camps. It's a common thing to say in sort of say this type of nutrition work that like the win for one person is eating the cake, and the win for another person is not eating the cake. So it just depends on their individual circumstances. But I would say like a lot of this is, I think, dependent on someone's motivation for the action. And I think it's a lot of it is like consider how flexible or how rigid someone is in their behaviors overall. Like how much distress does having your granny's cake in that case cause, or not? Because you can, I suppose, is an important point, and I work with a lot of sort of compassion focused therapy as well. So you can be compassionate while being kind of straight with yourself, that it's like, okay, I in retrospect I wouldn't have those biscuits in this case, right? But you can do that without tearing into yourself and sort of bringing up all this shame and then creating a threat response, which then may drive these people towards emotional eating to kind of soothe that. That's where that very tricky cycle can come into it, that if you shame yourself for something related to food or exercise, and then that leads you to cope or self-soothe with, overeating, for example, or emotional eating, then you're stuck in kind of a very bad cycle there for you. So what's the difference, rigidity versus flexibility? What's someone's kind of assessment of that behavior? How do they relate to it? Again, is it kind of like, okay, I kind of see what happened there. Maybe I do have to work on saying no, but it's okay, it is what it is, but we'll go at it again later or tomorrow. It's not going to be that big of a problem. But if it causes someone significant amounts of distress, I would say that's a bit of a red flag that, like, if they're catastrophizing having had the biscuits or the cake or whatever it is, and how do they respond to that, is very relevant. But no, I generally work with people like to make it so their behaviors are most in line with how they want them to be. So whatever's getting in the way of that is kind of the target of CBT, kind of at a high level. What else is, yeah, I mean, there's other things that, like, over exercising or being overly restrictive, or rigidity can come into like tracking as well. It's like, how hard is it for you to not track on a given day? Like, you could find it useful and you could prefer to track, but does it cause genuine distress or anxiety, the idea of not tracking or not miss or missing a workout? What are the, how would you like say this is relating to your quality of life, I think is a big part of it. How much time does you spend thinking about, like, I would have an eating disorder screen in my like client intake questionnaires, right? So it asks about things like, is sort of managing food and calories on your mind so much that it's distracting you from other parts of your life? Like, basically, how much of the headspace is it taking up? And how consuming is it? And how hard is it for you to keep going through that, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think you're right though about like the slice of cake. Like some people saying no can be a win because they're such a people pleaser, and then another person's no could be, if I have this cake, like I will feel like crap and I'll berate myself and I just don't want to put myself through that. But another person could be like, oh, it's just a slice of cake, it's a birthday party, I probably had a slice of cake. I probably haven't had one in weeks, it's not a big deal. I'll get back up the next day and continue as normal. And I suppose when I'm coaching people at the start, a lot of people would have the mindset of, oh no, I'm not allowed to have this, I'm not allowed to have that, and that's bad, I'm trying to be good, like all that type of language. And then, by the time that they finish working with me, whether it be like an 8-week challenge or a one-on-one setting, it's great to see, oh, I had a weekend away and I didn't beat myself up for the first time in a long time. And it's because you're trying to, I suppose, instill though that positive in our voice, that It's very seldom you do this, you know. It matters what we do most of the time. That's some of the time when they used to use the language of, I'm trying to be good, I can't have that, I can't have this. Or they even feel nervous before they go on a weekend away with their partner. And what another question I had for you is, do you often get people who like leave, I suppose, they've been under your wing for so long and now it's time for them to be on their own two feet. Like, do they ever have like that fear of what happens if I bounce back to old habits? Because I often have people who say that to me that, you know, they might finish an 8-week challenge or the one-on-one coaching. Oh, you know, I'm afraid to go by myself now. I've been under your wing for so long. I don't know if I can do this. Like, you know, what type of advice would you have for someone who has come out the other side of it and they've made tons of progress, but they still have that self-doubt?
Yeah, I think that's pretty common. And you know, with something like therapy, we can, you know, start to reduce the frequency of it as a way to, like, you know, we'll go from weekly to every fortnight to eventually, like, maybe only once a month, and then they're getting sort of more and more exposure to doing it on their own. And you can do a similar approach with coaching as well. Like, sometimes I'll do that too, where, you know, you could revert to checking in once a month rather than checking in every week, or checking in every 2 weeks instead of every week. And then people kind of build up the confidence in doing it that way, because, you know, they're getting that kind of, they're getting some support, but they're not going from, like, you know, weekly check-ins to nothing. But when people are finishing up, like, I'm always very firm on, like, them understanding what is working for them and why, because I think kind of a risk for it is just kind of coaching in general, but a risk is that, you know, people do just go back to old habits instead of keeping up the new habits. Like, if they're viewing it as, like, okay, I did this for 8 weeks now, and now I can sort of wash my hands of that, and that's obviously not the right attitude to have, because then it's not a kind of a longer term thing. So I use this example of, you know, what does your own blueprint for success look like based on what we've done over the last, you know, 6 months or whatever it is, and why is it working? What skills have you learned, and how have you put them into practice? Because, like, realistically, like, you know, we can't do it for them, so they are doing it themselves the whole time. Like, you know, I'm helping them build skills, and I'm giving them guidance on how to put that into practice, and helping them with the troubleshooting, the problem solving of, like, you know, the practical, maybe nutrition stuff, but ultimately they are the ones doing it. So, and, you know, you are, you know, the type of person you are is just based on what you do kind of on a regular basis. So if you are doing these things on a regular basis, then you are that type of person. So, you know, what are you worried about? But no, I understand the concern. So we have this kind of idea of the blueprint, and we'll go through that with them in quite a lot of detail. And the way I frame this is, you know, Men in Black movie,
Yeah.
right? So, you know, the mind wiping device that they have, right? Yeah, so it's somewhat iconic. So it's like, okay, imagine that you got your memory wiped with that thing, but you'd written out your blueprint, and you came across it, and it would tell you exactly everything you need to do to be successful in this kind of nutrition and fitness stuff. It's like, what would be in that manual? You know, you having nothing else except that to go on. So I try to get clear on that with people. But, you know, I think if they are building habits, then those will be somewhat sustainable. And that goes for, like, you know, psychological habits as well, you know, because not getting hooked by thoughts or being able to notice and name and neutralize them is a skill, right? So if someone has been practicing that, then they're obviously better at it than when they started. So they're more in a position to be able to go forward. But we'll always talk about, like, relapse prevention anyway. It's like, what are your kind of early warning signs going to be? You know, what's that kind of light that comes on your car dash? Like, what's that for you in relation to this that might say, oh, right, that's just a little kind of, not even a red flag, a little small orange flag that I need to sort of pay more attention to this. And, you know, what's going on? What brought that up? That kind of self-awareness is important. But we'll always talk about relapse kind of prevention anyway, and then just say, like, you know, if that playlist starts going again, or it's really loud, like, what do you do? And yeah, basically just kind of being proactive with it, and doing that bit of preparation. Yeah, and yeah, all the coaching that I would do up until now is kind of one to one. So, they'll have that kind of short time frame of like 8 weeks, but I would say it's maybe more difficult to do in that context because you've only so much time with somebody. But yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally makes sense. I think that's a really, really good analogy, the Men in Black one, because, or if you were to even say, if you had to describe this blueprint to a friend, if you were trying to teach them that, you basically have to list out the step-by-step process and what's involved. And I suppose it's nearly like self-reassurance when you're reading it on paper or you're able to recite it. It's like learning lines. And I think on that, and I always say that to my own clients as well. We check in once a week. I may have given you the blueprint, but you had to spend, the guts of 24/7 with yourself, and you were able to do that. So, trust yourself that you can do this. And like I like the idea as well of kind of weaning them out of check-ins as well, like, from 1 week to 2 weeks and then to monthly. That's a really good approach instead of just cutting the cord altogether. But if for anyone listening, I suppose, just to kind of to finish off, I would say a lot of people attempt, these kind of crash diets, all or nothing approach, etc. And sometimes it's not down to, them looking for shortcuts, I suppose, not all the time. Sometimes it's down to their support systems, the people around them maybe giving them kind of not so great information. People in the staff room, people in the group chat, etc. But if for someone who does attempt these crash diets, all or nothing approach, etc., and they're having like these binge restrict cycles because of these crash diets, and that's how the inner critic starts as well. Well, I couldn't stick to all these other ones, I'm not going to be able to stick to a calorie deficit, but there's obviously a different approach here. It's flexible dieting. Do you know what I mean? Like there is no restriction in involved. But for someone who does have a binge or the overeat, or they have like a mad weekend and they're supposed to be in a deficit and they're sitting there the next morning and they're beating themselves up and they're thinking, I'm after trying this calorie deficit now and I went overboard this weekend again. This is another diet I can't stick to. Even though the word diet actually just means the type of food they are eating, it doesn't mean that you're in a calorie deficit. What advice, if it was a friend of yours who was like, beating themselves up, oh, I was doing so well for 3 weeks and I ate like 3,000 calories last night, I'm spiraling, I can't stick to anything, what kind of advice or words of affirmation would you give someone like that to be like, just it's not the end of the world, it's just in the grand scheme of things, it's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, I think first off, I think I'm trying to empathize with how they're feeling. Okay, so you had plans to stick to this diet and sort of had a day or a weekend where you had too much. So, do you feel quite frustrated about that, or hopeless even, if this is like, multiple attempts at trying to do this? So I would empathize with how they're feeling first before trying to kind of reassure them, because that kind of disregards or dismisses how they actually might be feeling. Because if they're feeling hopeless and you're like, oh well, you'll be fine, like, because you can just kind of crack on with it and it's not the end of the world, which is true. But I think you always start with empathy and then exploration of what happened. What do you think happened here? What do you think you should do next? And sort of talk that through with them and see how they're thinking about it. And then I think if, say, if someone's working on this, that they build up those psychological flexibility skills, they're not going to get overly tangled up in all the negative self-talk and beating themselves up anyway. And they'll have learned to be more compassionate, to then be able to move on from that and keep working towards whatever the goals are. But I think empathizing and then trying to understand why this happened in the first place, because otherwise, like, if it's so a recurring pattern, then it would seem like you need to address it and understand, what's going on or what's the limiting factor here. Because otherwise people could just end up repeating the same patterns, of course, and that won't exactly serve them that well. But yeah, not getting too t tangled up in those unhelpful or negative thoughts that they might have about that, you know, in terms of evaluating that, and then saying like, okay, what do I need to do next? Any sort of binge eating, like I would always say, like don't try and compensate for that in some way. Just, you know, go back to one of the nice things about nutrition is what I've said for quite a while is like the opportunity to have a, you know, an on plan or a better meal comes around pretty quickly, you know, because we're several times a day. So don't be trying to do like compensatory exercise, or don't be like skipping meals or trying to like drastically undereat to compensate, because those will all just sort of make it more risky that it'll happen again, and then sort of send, kind of sends the wrong message to yourself in terms of, you know, what I did was so wrong that I must now make amends for it, which I don't think is that helpful. So yeah, that's somewhere along the lines of what I think I would say in that case.
I know, many years ago I used to be that person. If I overeat the next day, I would be like doing double the cardio, and then what happens is you just develop a worse relationship with food then, because you equal exercise to punishment, and I suppose you nearly get turned off exercise then. You associate the treadmill or the Stairmaster with a place of punishment when it should be a place to get fit, and look after your cardiovascular health rather than, like, I suppose, a calorie sentence, or a binge sentence. But all that advice was A1, Brian, and I really hope it's helped people, or even made people, I suppose, more self-aware. And do I actually need to reach out for help? And am I maybe overthinking? Is it just kind of a once in a blue moon that I have, or I overeat, or do I ha actually have to speak to someone about this? Because, like we said at the start, sometimes you think a calorie deficit is the solution to the weight gain, but the root of the problem is not going to be fixed by a calorie deficit. Sometimes it has to go or delve deeper, and that's where someone like yourself comes in. And if someone does want to reach out to you, Brian, where can they find you on socials?
So I'm pretty active on Instagram, at Brian Oengusa, and then the company that I work for is Triage Method. So we have social media channels for Triage as well, and we do sort of like a multidisciplinary coaching, health, sort of thing with like physios and nutritionists, and then myself as a therapist and trainers and stuff. So and we have loads of content on our website for people to try and help themselves. You know, if they can take the time to read it, they'll get a lot out of that. So that's triagemethod.com. Yeah, and then we're trying to get the YouTube kind of more consistent this year, but there is some videos on YouTube at Triage Method, but better videos to come over the next kind of 12 months or so, I would say.
Yeah, I think your Instagram has a lot of your personal Instagram has a lot of great reels and tips and advice and stuff,
Thank
and
you.
it's very, very helpful, very insightful. A lot of stuff that people probably aren't aware of, stuff that doesn't even exist, stuff that they probably don't think they even suffer with, and they probably do. And you really kind of break it down in layman's terms, because I think what can happen as well is that kind of jargon of language that, the normal Joe soap doesn't speak, and they can kind of just get overwhelmed and be like, whoa, this is too much. But likes yourself, like you really do break it down into layman's terms. And I will tag you in the summary of this podcast, so people know where to find you if they want to reach out. But I really appreciate your time today, Brian, and again, I hope it's helped someone, even if it's one person. And hopefully we have you on again soon as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate you having me on, first of all, but the feedback as well. I'm glad it sort of comes across kind of more straightforward, because that's what I'm trying for, to not, because it is easy to get into jargon. I was on a podcast earlier on today and kind of was aware of myself getting into jargon, talking about like the research on binge eating that I did. So called myself out on it, but yeah, I appreciate that, and yeah, would be very happy to come back another time. So let me know.
Yeah, I'd have so many more questions to ask you, but we want to keep it short and sweet as well, not to overwhelm listeners. But yeah, 100%. And I hope if there's any questions or anything that come in, I'll send them on to you too. But yeah, really appreciate it, Brian. I hope you have a lovely evening.
Thanks, Anya.